you very much. Thank you. Well, first of all, I want to thank all of you for giving me this opportunity. This is the fourth Commodity Classic I've had the privilege to attend, and I'm certainly glad to be here. I'm particularly glad to be here today. It's always great to be outside of Washington. And on this day in particular, it's really great to be outside of Washington. Yeah, I want to echo the comments that you just heard about the leadership of the commodity groups here. I've had an opportunity to visit with the leaders before this speech, and I can tell you that we have a good, close, personal relationship, and we had a great conversation about the future of agriculture and some of the challenges that we face. And I want you to know that we're committed to working with you. I know this has been a difficult time, and for many, many reasons. And I thought I would start off my remarks today by doing what every U.S. Secretary of Agriculture should do, in fact, what every American should do, with an expression of appreciation for what you all do for us every single day, and what your families do, and what farmers and producers all across this great land do every single day. You not only produce all of the food that we need, allowing us to be a food secure nation, you also create enough through your use of technology and new techniques, your willingness to embrace science, your understanding of the research, that we're able to export much of what we grow to the rest of the world. In doing so, we not only help feed the rest of the world, but we also create job opportunities here. We've enjoyed four of the best export years in the history of American agriculture, and that's helped to support nearly a million jobs here at home. So you're not only a food provider, you're also a job creator. In addition to that, the work that you do on your farms, the embracing of conservation techniques, the willingness to be the greatest and best stewards of land and water also impacts most of the drinking water that Americans consume, regardless of where they live. And if you think about it, most of the energy source that this country uses to light our homes and to power our businesses and to fuel our cars comes from rural America, where you all live, work, and raise your families. And an ever-increasing amount of it's coming from what you produce in the form of biomass, crops that are being converted into these fuels and energy supplies. And it's allowed us to reduce our reliance on foreign oil to one of the lowest points in over a decade. When I started this job, we imported 62% of our oil from foreign nations, some of which did not necessarily agree with us. Today, it's less than 45%, and it's dropping steadily. So America owes all of you and owes all of the producers and farmers in this country an extraordinary debt of gratitude. You've made us a stronger and clearly a more secure nation. So I wanted to make sure that I said this at the beginning, and I know that there are probably very likely people in this audience who themselves have served in the military, but who may have a son or a daughter or a grandson or granddaughter or a niece or nephew or maybe just a kid down the road that you know well. Because it's not only all of this that rural America provides, it's also supporting our military in unprecedented numbers. I say this in every speech I give. Rural America represents 16% of America's population, which is the lowest level it's been in our history. But yet nearly 40% of our military comes from those small towns, from those farms, and from those ranches. Not only are you a contributing group of folks to this country, but you are enormous innovators. And you are some of the most productive people in this country. Since 1980, farming has been the second most productive aspect of our economy, in large part because of the adoption of new technologies and new techniques. Just yesterday, I was in the White House at a meeting with all of the CEOs and high-ranking officials from virtually all of the agricultural biotechnology companies in America. And one of the most startling statistics that was shared during that meeting was the fact that last year, when we faced the worst drought we had seen since the 1930s, a drought that impacted and affected virtually every area of our great country, we still had the fifth largest corn crop in the history of America. It's an extraordinary statistic, and it speaks to the capacity of American agriculture to embrace technology to be more productive. And you all know and appreciate the fact that that technology has to continue to be embraced if we're to face an enormous challenge over the course of the next several decades. To increase world food population by 70% will require us to produce as much food in that 30 to 40 year period by 2050 as we've produced, in essence, in the previous 10,000 years. This is an enormous challenge for us. But I have no doubt the people in this room and the people across this great country can meet that challenge if they have the right partner. Now, we have at USDA been very concerned about the drought, and we took steps last year to try to mitigate and minimize the impact of that drought. And we looked at opening up CRP land for our livestock producers, and we tried to work an arrangement with crop insurance companies so that you would receive a grace period on crop insurance payments in the fall. We lowered the interest rate on disaster loans. We made them a little easier to get. We worked with the SBA to expand a partnership to ensure that credit was available to larger farming operations. And we also made sure that we didn't create a barrier to cover crop production this year through our crop insurance programs by creating some flexibility. We took additional steps to begin thinking longer term about the drought. And so a task force was formed at the President's instruction, and he asked me to chair that task force through the Rural Council. A couple of things that we have done as a result of that task force was to enter into an agreement with the Commerce Department to do an even better job of forecasting. Part of our challenge is always to know what Mother Nature has in store for us. We believe if we do a better job of collecting data, of working through that data, we might have a more accurate forecasting opportunities so you all can plan and have greater certainty in what your operations. We also understand and appreciate that we have to attend to our water resources in this country, and we've got to do it in a way that allows us to do a better job of storage and preservation of those water resources. And the President mentioned recently in a speech to the nation's governors the investments that must be taken to improve our water storage capacity, as well as our transportation systems, our locks, our dams, our ports, so that product can get to market effectively and competitively. We're certainly pleased that the Corps of Engineers worked hard this year to keep the Mississippi River open, which allowed nearly 60% of our agricultural products that go through the Mississippi to have unfettered access to transportation and to markets. But this drought was a wake-up call for us. It was a wake-up call in terms of making sure that we understood and appreciated the impact of a changing climate. Now, there may be discussion in this country about the cause of changing climates, but there's no question that the world is getting a bit warmer. There's no question that we're seeing more intense weather patterns as a result. As a result of all of this, USDA worked hard to create two assessments, which we recently filed, two reports. And I encourage you to take a look at the reports that are on our website. They talk about the long-term implications of a changing climate, and we're a call to action at USDA for us to focus on strategies that will help you mitigate and adapt to climate change. And so what we're going to do over the course of the next 12 months is begin a process of creating in regional areas across the country a more focused effort on the research that we need to do now to give you the tools later as you begin to address the challenges of a changing climate, whether it's too little water or too much water, whether it's new pests and diseases that cause problems, whether it's more intense weather patterns that create huge storms that impact your crops adversely. We've got to be thinking about ways in which we can help you mitigate those consequences. We also have to put more effort into our research, and that's one of the reasons why we will make a concerted effort this year in the President's budget and in our discussions with Congress to see if there's a way in which we can find the resources, even in this limited resource situation we find ourselves in, to begin investing more in agricultural research. I think folks in Washington finally realize that for far too long that area has been ignored. There has not been as much attention to the research in agriculture as there needs to be, and we need to begin creating a process by which it's put on a par with healthcare research. We're also very interested in developing from that research new products. And while this may not be quite topical, the fact is we are in Florida. This is a great citrus producer down here, and they are dealing with a very terrible challenge in their citrus industry with citrus greening, which causes the premature dropping of oranges, which in turn makes it more difficult for those oranges to be used in the market. Just yesterday, I had a meeting with our folks at ARS, Ed Nippling, who's the director and administrator of ARS, and he showed me a packet of organic matter that contained dead bacteria. That's the exciting part of my job. Ed was excited about this because this packet contained potentially a response to the vector of the citrus greening issue, that the insect that causes citrus greening, that this bacteria, even though it's dead, is a toxin. And if it's consumed by this insect, it kills the insect and reduces the opportunity of that insect to transfer the citrus greening disease. As a result of this formulation, which was developed in ARS labs, we now have several companies around America that are beginning to produce this product, and it's helping to create jobs. This is the power of agricultural research, solving problems for the producer and creating jobs throughout the country. So we obviously want to continue that as well. We also will be focusing this year on other strategies to continue to diversify agriculture and continue to create new opportunities. And it occurred to us that we weren't doing as good a job as we should talking about or educating producers about the benefits of multi-cropping. Recognizing that there are cover crop options, there are multi-cropping options, there are crop and livestock integrated operation options, and there are agroforestry options. We felt the necessity of pointing out some of the benefits, the conservation benefits from multi-cropping. As we deal with this changing climate and adaptation, one strategy is to use multi-cropping to preserve soil quality and to preserve scarce water resources. So over the course of the next year, you will see us being focused on additional research in the multi-cropping area, making sure we know precisely the impact that certain cover crops and multi-crops will have on the primary crop that you're growing, ways in which we can create that cover crop more efficiently, making sure we have information about proper timing of planting, reducing the barriers in our crop insurance programs to multi-cropping and cover cropping that exist today, doing a better job of explaining the conservation benefits, and as importantly, creating new market opportunities. It seems to me that there is an unlimited situation here, and I said this at the White House yesterday. There's an unlimited opportunity that is represented by the producers in this room and the producers all across the United States to create new industries that have never existed before. The ability to take plant material and crop residue and livestock waste and convert it not just into fuel and energy, which we're doing today, but into chemicals and plastics and fabrics and fibers, which can remake the American economy, can rebuild manufacturing in rural areas, redefine innovation in this country, reduce our reliance on fossil fuels and imported energy sources, make our country stronger and more secure, that agriculture is going to play that critical role in the future economy of the United States. To be able to do that, we obviously need to be able to create the biomass and convert the biomass and sell the biomass and use it in a way that's effective. And I think there are literally unlimited opportunities. So we'll be spending a lot of time this year on helping to create that opportunity. We're also going to make sure that we understand that in diversifying agriculture, that we recognize the role of all different types of production systems. Direct-to-consumer sales, local and regional food systems are important. Organic production is a little bit different than commodity production, and so we need to recognize that. We need to create new opportunities for this multi-billion-dollar agricultural opportunity, but we also need to do it in a way that allows producers to do what they need to do on their operation without necessarily interfering with each other. That's why we put together our AC21 committee, working very hard to figure out ways in which we can create better coexistence and better sense of community within agriculture, bringing people together, trying to eliminate the conflicts that have existed in the past. And the AC21 committee has made a set of recommendations. We'll be working on those this year. Those recommendations will have us focus on the research in terms of knowing and understanding gene flow, on preserving germplasm to make sure that we can continue to have a wide diversity of seed opportunities in this country, to work on ways in which we can do a better job of stewardship and create best practices in stewardship so folks can get along in the same community together, and working with organic producers to create for them what commodity producers already have and use in great abundance, which is a crop insurance effort to protect against an economic loss. So we're going to be quite active at USDA. Now, all of this great work in adapting to climate change and focusing on new income opportunities, on coexistence, depends a little bit on Congress. How do you all feel about that? It depends on Congress giving us a farm bill, a 5-year program with certainty, a farm bill that understands, even in this difficult fiscal circumstance we find ourselves in, that producers in this country, because of the benefits that you all provide and because of the risks that are associated with what happens when Mother Nature doesn't cooperate, a farm bill that creates a strong, strong safety net. That's a fundamental principle of any farm bill. And that safety net must include a commitment to crop insurance and a continuation of that commitment to crop insurance, an equitable deal between the government and producers and the insurance company, to ensure, as we needed this year, protection. That drought made a difference. It impacted crop production, even with bountiful crops. Not everybody shared in that. So we've paid out nearly $14.7 billion in indemnity payments this year. It's likely to go up to between $15 and $17 billion. But this is the first year, probably in the last 10 or 11, where crop insurance carriers will probably pay out more than they took in. On the whole, it's been a profitable business. It's been a good relationship. It needs to continue. We need to create ways in which we can supplement and augment crop insurance for those producers who want additional protection so that we have a strong safety net. This 5-year farm bill must also include a commitment to exports. We've had, as I said earlier, 4 of the best export years in the history of this country, and this year is expected to be a record year. We've seen new opportunities, especially in the beef industry in Japan, in Korea, and Mexico, and Hong Kong recently. Barriers are coming down. Exports are up. The first 3 months of this fiscal year, exports were up 15%. And we're headed to a record year. But we need those programs approved in the Farm Bill that will allow us to continue to promote trade. Every dollar we spend in trade promotion of agricultural products produces $35 of trade, and every $1 billion of ag trade helps to support 7,800 jobs at home. That energy bill must also make a commitment to rural America with a strong energy title and expanding it to this new bioeconomy I spoke about and supporting it with programs. It needs to continue the commitment to conservation, but streamlining our conservation programs so they're easier to understand and more flexible to meet the needs of individual producers and to focus on watershed opportunities. There's a lot of work that can be done and will be done and great partnerships that can be formed, but we need greater flexibility in that conservation program. It needs to make a commitment to local and regional food systems and organic because that's part of a growing aspect of agriculture, and it's a way of connecting to people who live in cities and suburbs about the importance and significant role that agriculture plays, both in their lives of providing food and also in the economy and building a sense of community. All of that needs to focus on building this new rural economy that focuses on production, agriculture, and exports, local and regional food systems, the bioeconomy, and conservation linked to outdoor recreation, helping to build new opportunities so that we can encourage our young people to think about careers and lives in those small towns in which they grew. It's also about making sure there's adequate credit and a commitment to research. So we need a 5-year farm bill. But I suppose before we get to a five-year farm bill, we need a budget. And this has been a very difficult time for those who work at USDA. And I don't expect you to necessarily have sympathetic feelings about this, but this is a workforce over the last 3 years that's not had a pay increase. This is a workforce that faced last year the real threat of a government shutdown where their jobs would be put on hold. This is a workforce where over the last 3 years we have reduced our workforce by 8%, 6,500 workers, which means that somebody's doing double duty. This is a workforce whose operating budget, with the sequester that goes into effect today, will be less than it was in 2009. This is a workforce that really has had very little, if any, increases in budget for the last 3 years. This is a workforce that's now faced with sequester. And it's a workforce that is dedicated to you, dedicated to providing a degree of service to you that you depend on. But because of the sequester, our operating budget will be reduced by somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion to $1.5 billion. And you think, well, that's not a lot of money. But the way this is structured, every line item of our budget and every account that's not exempted by Congress has to be cut by a certain percentage. It's not a situation where we can take money from conservation and move it over into the Foreign Ag Service to make sure that trade isn't disrupted, or take money from a nutrition account and put it into food safety. Every account, every mission area, treated separately, but with the same level and percentage of cut. This is a workforce that understands that that cut has to be implemented in the remaining part of the fiscal year. So to give you a sense of this, if we're talking about somewhere between a 5, 6, 7, 8% cut, those are annual numbers. But if you only have 6 months left in the fiscal year, it's basically double that in terms of your remaining money. So if you have to cut your budget annually by 6%, you have to cut the remaining part of your budget that you have left by 12% to get to that 6% number. This is a workforce that understands the following consequences. And the Farm Service Agency, they know today when the President signs the order, because an agreement hasn't been reached, that there will be 34 to 35 million fewer credit dollars available for producers, which means roughly 1,500 folks who needed credit to operate or own a farm will not have access to that credit. They just simply won't be in business, or they won't be able to operate. It means that those folks at NRCS who want to do work on conservation will have to say to 2,600 people, we simply don't have the resources to be able to even help you get a conservation plan. And to another 11 to 12,000 people, you've got a plan, but we won't have the resources to fund the plan. It means for those folks who work in the Foreign Ag Service that they'll have fewer dollars to use in trade promotion. They won't be able to help the small businesses that are helping to promote the products that you all help to produce. And the facts are that that will probably mean about $500 million fewer trade opportunities, and Lord knows what it will do with our competitors and their ability to go into foreign markets and suggest that perhaps the American market is not as certain as it once was. And that may have long-term impacts. It means that those folks who work in research are going to have to let their land-grant university partners know that there's probably going to be about $60 million fewer dollars for research and probably 100 projects that we're not going to be able to fund, and all the people who were hired to do those projects won't be able to be hired. It'll mean roughly those folks working in nutrition, they'll have to tell 600,000 women, infants, and children that they won't be able to access the WIC program and the nutritional assistance and help because they're going to be put on a waiting list. And it means to all those folks who work or rely on meat to be processed and pork to be processed and poultry to be processed and eggs to be processed that there will be a disruption in that process. Because make no mistake about it, there is not enough flexibility in this sequester language for me to move money around to avoid furloughs of food inspectors. It is not something I want to do. It's not something I like doing. But it is the law, and it's something I'm going to have to do unless this thing gets resolved. And when I do, it's not an inspector who's impacted, the roughly 8,000 inspectors and over 6,600 inspection facilities. It's the 250,000 other folks who work in those facilities whose lives are also going to be impacted. And it's going to be a loss of export opportunity because product will not be produced on those days when inspectors are furloughed because no meat can be processed on those days. And it's estimated that we're looking at potentially $8 billion less in exports. And that's roughly 60,000 jobs in addition to the 250,000 jobs, in addition to the 8,000 inspectors. And some may say, well, Mr. Secretary, can't you move money around? Can't you reduce the spending on travel and supplies and so forth? Well, folks, we've been doing that for the last 3 years. We saw this train coming down the track, and we really focused, as you would expect us to do from rural areas. You would expect us to be anticipating this. You would be expecting us to do a better job of using your taxpayer dollars wisely. So we engaged in this thing called the Blueprint for Stronger Service. It has involved closing 250 offices and labs and locations in every mission area across the USDA, reducing the workforce by 8%, strategically sourcing our purchases of technology and telecommunications equipment, saving millions of dollars, condensing the space that we have and not renting as much space as we used to, cutting down travel, cutting down supplies, cutting down conferences. The sum total of all that we've done up to this point is at least conservatively $700 million in savings and probably closer to $1 billion in savings. So we've done all of that easy lifting. So when they come and they say, take another 5 or 6% and do it in a 6 or 7 month period and do it in every line item, there's just not a lot that can be done. And frankly, I have to apologize to all of you because this is crazy what's happening. This shouldn't happen. In a functioning democracy, this shouldn't happen. People should recognize that we have fiscal issues and we've got to address them. And it's a combination of additional revenue and cuts. And it's a combination of doing some difficult, heavy lifting in programs that we love and tax loopholes and tax cuts that we love that we have to sacrifice and give up on. If everybody just gave a little, we could get this done. But unfortunately, what's happened in Washington is that nobody's listening to all of you. No one's listening to the reasonable people out in the countryside who just scratch their head at coffee shops and say, why can't they get along? Why can't they compromise? Why can't they reach a consensus? When everybody in the country knows what that consensus is. We're going to do our level best at USDA. Our level best at USDA to do this equitably, just to give you a sense of the challenges. There are some programs where we've already sent money out to people, and we still have money yet to send out to other people. When you have to cut the budget, what do? Do you ask those folks who've already got their money to pay it back, or do you cut the folks who haven't gotten their money a little deeper? These are hard questions. So I said to our team yesterday, we're going to have three basic principles. First of all, we're going to be as equitable as we can be. Similarly situated folks ought to be treated similarly. Nobody should get a break. Everybody should be treated equally, if that's possible. Secondly, we should try to do this in a way that is the least disruptive to the people we care about. The farmers, the ranchers, the producers, the people who live, work, and raise their family in rural communities and those struggling families who need nutrition assistance. And third, we need to care about the people that work at USDA because they're the ones delivering the services. And we need to do this in a way that is fair to them as well. And that's my commitment to you. This is going to be a tough situation. It's going to require a lot of thought. It's already required an enormous amount of time, time that's not being spent on all the issues that we just discussed, climate change and trade and research and credit and farm bill and crop insurance and exports. I mean, all of these things that are important to us. And your panel discussion, and I'll close with this, your panel discussion talked about relevance. I want to make sure that people understand the message that I tried to convey. It wasn't that rural America is not relevant. It is absolutely relevant. It is probably never more relevant. I would argue it's one of the most relevant places in America. What I said was its political relevance is in question. That's different. Its political relevance is the ability to get things done in Washington, to be able to move and convince and cajole folks to get things done in Washington. And the reason is fairly simple. We're fewer and fewer folks living in rural areas and fewer people who call themselves farmers as it relates to the rest of the population. You're less than 1% of the population, the most liberal definition of a farmer. And the folks in this room who represent the people who produce most of what we consume, you all represent 0.1% of the population, as important as you are. And for us to be politically relevant, for us to put the fear of God in folks to get a farm bill done and to get sequester resolved and to get a budget to provide certainty and clarity so that you all can do what you do best and do better than anyone else in the world, we got to figure out ways in which we can enlarge our political relevance. Part of it involves making sure that we are strategically aligned, working not just with commodity groups, not just within agriculture, but all the peoples whose lives depend on you. We ought to be encouraging them to stand up. All those people who handle exports, those small business owners, those people at the ports who load stuff on those ships, those shippers, they have a stake in your future. They ought to be engaged in helping us get that future become more certain. We need to be strategically aligned. We need to reach out to those folks in the nutrition world and understand that we're sort of joined at the hip. Whether we like it or not, we're joined at the hip, and we ought to be working together to get the legislation and the budget that supports the programs that are important to the people we care about. Strategically aligned, not in conflict. We need to have a proactive message, especially to our young people. What an amazing opportunity we have in rural America. The ability to go to a young person who cares deeply about the moral challenges of their generation and say to them, you can address the most fundamental moral challenge of your time, how we feed an ever-increasing world population, and that can be done in rural America. Or we can converse with a young person who's excited about the environment and wants to protect it and wants to enhance it to say, you know, if you're dealing with climate change, if you're dealing with water resources, the answers, the solutions, the opportunities are in rural America. If you want to remake the American economy, if you want to build new businesses that reduce reliance on foreign supplies of oil and become a more secure, energy secure, and economically secure America, that opportunity is not necessarily in a city. It is in rural America, in a small town, on a farm and on a ranch. It's a proactive message. We have hundreds of thousands of kids who are excited about that opportunity. So we have to move our message beyond the difficulties and challenges that we face, the regulatory concerns that we have, the tax concerns we have. I understand that those are really important, but if that's all young people hear about, they don't get the fact that there's this enormous opportunity that exists. And there are no better messengers than the folks in this room. So we need to strategically align. We need to have proactive messages. And we need to extend the influence of agriculture. It's one of the reasons why I sent an email to Chuck Hagel, now that he's the Secretary of Defense, congratulating him on getting a job and reminding him that we could be partners together in building this new economy by focusing on the Navy's efforts to convert half of their fuel from fossil fuel-based fuel and energy to bio-based, American-produced-based fuel and energy. Extending the reach of USDA, extending the reach of rural America, extending the reach of farming and ranching and producing. It's a great story. It's an inspiring story. It's an American story. We all saw that ad during the Super Bowl. I'm a Steeler fan. Trust me, it was really hard to watch the Ravens in the Super Bowl. So I watched it for the ads, and frankly, I was kind of disappointed until that ad showed up. And I don't know about you, but I couldn't figure out what the product was until the end. It was a great ad because it talked about the character and the resilience, the significance, the importance of what you all do. We, each of us, has the capacity to convey that same message with that same level of emotion and passion. And if we do, then we will begin to increase the number of people interested in what we do. We'll increase the number of people who want to do what we do. We'll expand the populations of rural communities. We'll revive the economies. We'll be able to make the case to young people that there's no better place, no better place in America to live, work, and raise a family than in a small town on a farm or ranch. We'll be able to expand the population. And in doing so, we'll get more attention to the issues that involve rural America. We'll become more politically relevant. That's the message. So, my one ask of you today, as I leave, as I thank you for what you do, is to stand up and say to our leaders in Washington, forget about the party. Forget about the political leaders. Forget about the people who fund your campaign. For that matter, forget about the next campaign. Think about me. Think about us. Do your job. End the sequester. Get a budget passed. Give us a good, solid 5-year farm bill. And if you do, what we will deliver is what we have always delivered: the greatest agricultural production in the history of mankind. We'll help produce new products and new innovations. We'll continue to do a better job of stewardship of our land and our water and our natural resources. We'll expand habitat opportunities. We'll bring more people to the outdoors. We'll create new products. We'll export American agriculture to the rest of the world. We'll help feed the world. We'll make America a stronger and more solid nation, a more moral nation. We will do all of that. We will do our job. Just do yours. Thank you very much.
Mr. Secretary, stand right here. Stand right here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great job. Great job. We love you.
Political relevance.
Oh, absolutely.
I forgot to mention this. I should mention this.
Go ahead.
You know, folks, appreciate that. Part of the problem that I have is I never speak from a prepared text, and therefore I forget things I'm supposed to say. So I brought this with me. Since we're in Florida, spring training season, what this is, it's called rubbing mud. And it's what they put on the baseballs to make them so that the pitcher can throw them with greater control. You know, we've been throwing mud in Washington for a long time. I think we got to figure out how to use it more constructively, and this was the reminder. Thank you all. God bless you.
Well said. Thanks again. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to introduce the next part of our program that you're going to love.